was I?
And I did have one other question for you about Groundhog Day, because that was actually the first movie that I did cover on this podcast. I covered it for 38 episodes. And I imagine you've heard this before, but I'm curious what your thought is about the recent theory that Ned Ryerson is the devil and that he
look at that grin.
He's the one that lets Phil out of the loop once he finally buys life insurance.
I didn't hear that last turn. I did read the thing about Ned being the devil. No, I think the whole thing about time and Groundhog Day comes from Harold Ramis, in that he said, when we were, it was when that space shuttle blew up. When was that? That was the one that was so tragic. I was in New Mexico.
Challenger, 1986.
Yeah, I was in New Mexico with Harold Ramis and Danny Rubin, who wrote Groundhog Day at the time. We were at a charity event. And I was backstage with Harold saying, well, everybody's always talking about Groundhog Day and how long it is and how many days it is and all this kind of stuff. And Harold Ramis says, oh, well, I know that. He says, it's 10,000 years that Bill is trapped in time for 10,000 years. He says, because, Stephen, I'm a practicing Buddhist. And Buddhists believe that it takes 10,000 years to perfect the human soul. And that's the story of Groundhog Day, the perfection of the human soul. So the idea that Bill is trapped in whatever that is, is their memento construct of what they think they know is the truth. When the real truth is, it's a Buddhist story of how long it takes to perfect the human soul. And that's why Groundhog Day is such a great movie. Also, because as an audience, we sense that there is a profundity to it. And it's not just a bunch of silly repetitions. So, but I don't think Ned's the devil. I don't think that at all.
Oh, I love hearing that little Harold Ramis tidbit. I miss him terribly.
Yeah. Ugh. Great, 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 great man.
All right. Well, I think I'm going to pass it over to Lisa and let you ask your students questions.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm trying to categorize some of them a little bit here, because some of them are memento based. Some of them are for you in general as an actor. So, I mean, you've already told us so many, but I didn't know if there were any particular really interesting or funny stories about shooting Memento, maybe something that you saw in a scene that you weren't involved in, or if you've already given us the best ones.
I think I've given you the most important ones or the best ones. I think I remember the first scenes I shot were the scenes where I'm getting the psychological test.
Yes.
I think that was because that was the one scene that I had lines.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't really have much to do in line wise in that movie. So it was kind of a shocker to have the big scene, which is one paragraph, and it was like walking into an airplane propeller of like, oh my God, that was so difficult to do compared to doing the just scene where you had the script. So it will go down in my personal history as the most challenging thing I ever had to do was a scene with Harriet. That was incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
That's
absolutely beautiful scene. How would you compare your experience of playing Sammy Jenkins in Memento as an amnesiac who really is struggling to function properly in society with other productions where you're a more aware or respected figure?
Yeah, I had a great acting teacher who said acting is not about emotion, but it's about clarity of thought. And I think the thing actors do wrong all the time is they're worried about if they're, quote, emotional enough. And that's why, in high school, you get guys throwing chairs and women crying in every scene, and it's boring. Human beings are emotional 100% of the time. We're always emotional. We can't turn it off. I mean, when I watch the Shopping Channel, I get emotional. You cannot help it. But what creates a character is clarity of thought. What is my greatest wish? What is my greatest fear? What do I feel is my greatest strength, my greatest weakness? What is it that I want, my intention in the scene, which is why Memento was so difficult because you have to take that prong away.
Right.
So you have to know the world of the play or movie you're in, and you have to know your clarity of thought, what you want in the scene. And then everything else takes care of itself if you do that work, if you understand what's really at stake for you in a scene. Is it an important scene? Is it not an important scene? Is it the first time it's happened? Is it the 100th time it's happened? So you have to think through all of the specifics, which I think sometimes people don't do. And they just go like, well, you know, this terrible thing's happened to me. But how many times have terrible things happened to me and the police come and talk to me and I'm very just calm and cool. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, well, so, you know, and you go like, oh, gosh, if this had been a screenplay, I wonder if I ever would have acted it this way.
Right. Right. And there's no real telling, right, of like how you're going to react in a certain moment.
Lot of it is dependent on what is. I had a producer, Peter Noah, said, you always have to know the key of comedy you're in. If you're in a comedy, you have to know the key of comedy. You have to know what mode you're playing in. If you're Groundhog Day, are you the schlemiel or the schlemazel, as Harold Ramis would say? That in the world, you have two kinds of people. You have people who get soup spilled on them, and there are people who spill the soup on you. And in a scene, one person has to be the world, and the other person has to be the aberrant force in the world. So in Groundhog Day, Bill is the world. In my scenes with him, and I'm the aberrant force in the world. So Harold Ramis said to me, Stephen, you can be as big as you want because you're the hurricane. Bill has to be normal. He has to be us. And what's so amazing about Bill's performance in Groundhog Day, just talking about that, in the next scene after the street scene, he's in the diner scene with Andy, where Andy is the world and Bill is the hurricane, drinking the pot of coffee straight there and eating all the cake and being crazy. So you have to know what your role is in the scene if you're doing a comedy, and what the parameters of that world are. That's a lot of what your homework is as an actor.
That is so fascinating. I love that. I have a couple more. I promise. I appreciate the indulgence here. Do you have a favorite role that you've ever played? I mean, we're talking a lot about Memento and Groundhog Day, and I'm wondering if these two roles are particular at the top of your list, but do you have a personal favorite?
Well, Groundhog Day was certainly a great role in that it was a great movie. It was a great cast. Harold Ramis, great director. It was a great experience, and it was successful. Mm-hmm. You know, it hit all the bullet points. Certainly, for example, just recently doing One Day at a Time with Norman Lear and Rita Moreno and Justina Machado. And I mean, that cast,
incredible.
That show was an incredible experience. Every day it was like a party going to work. Doing Californication. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
Yes.
it was a party every time we went on the set. Every one of those actors was amazingly competent and amazingly good. We had the best directors. We had the best designers, the best camera people. And everybody on that show was so professional and so there, always in the moment. We always had a great time, and we always had a great time in front of the camera, which is why the show was successful in what it was, even though we were naked half the time. And it was a blast to do. Working on the Goldbergs is amazing, not just, you know, working with the cast, which is remarkable. But I have to say, in terms of the Goldbergs, this is something that young actors don't think about. It was the greatest crew I think I've worked with. And the Deadwood crew was equally great. I mean, the prop people, the lighting people, the sound people, the camera people, extraordinarily good. And you begin to understand how important the crew is to you being able to have the room and the headspace and the heart and the soul space to have a good performance, because everything is taken care of and all you have to do is be you and do your thing. So there are lots of different things that make shows good and make shows bad. You know, you can have a great script and then a terrible crew and you go like, oh God, What are we going to do? We're never going to get the work done today. So there are a lot of variables when you do a lot of different things.
Yeah. Okay. I have two more and then I'm going to, then I'm done. what has been your greatest realization in your career as an actor?
Okay. This is depressing. Is that none of it matters. You know, when you want to be an actor when you're young, I don't want to depress people out. You want to be an actor.
Drama students listening.
You want to make a statement. You want to make your statement in the world, and you want it to matter. And you feel like you're doing something important, and you're telling an important story, and you're out there and you're doing something important. And now I'm what, like almost 72? I'm a young 72. I sound like an old 72 because I have pneumonia now, but I'm a young 72. But at 72, you realize it's all gone. It's all gone. I take a look at the couple shows I did on Broadway. There's still some people that remember them and see them, and they'll come up to me on the street and they go, God, that was a great show. Or so, but it's gone. And then you think, well, something like Groundhog Day, that'll be here forever. Nope. I was doing Minx. For HBO. And in the show, the leading lady had to punch me in the face. And I was trying to say, well, if you do this, if you pull your fist back, that gives me the cue that you're about to come through. So you go back and then forward, and then the camera will be behind and I'll react and it'll look like you punched me in the face. And she was like going to the director, why do I have to listen to this guy? You know, why do I have to listen? You know, and I said, you know, if you just do this, then we'll be able to time it and it'll look good, because you can't go back and then hold and then not come through and then come through, because my timing is based on what you do. And then someone said, well, he did one of the great screen punches, you know, in film history in Groundhog Day with Bill Murray punching him.
Yeah.
And she says, oh, yeah, I heard that's a good movie.
Oh,
I should see it at some point. And then I hear it and I go like, oh, I got it. It's all gone.
Yeah.
So the idea is that all art you do is just like written in water. Everything you do doesn't really matter. So the freedom that gives you is that if you're in a great disaster, keep going, because no one will remember it. And as you get more insight, as you get older, you'll be able to share that much more, which will eventually be forgotten.
Yeah. It's interesting. There's a line of that in Palahniuk's Fight Club in the novel that talks about like freedom is what happens when you no longer care. Mm-hmm. And it's this idea of, you know, it sounds like such a negative thing, but it's that fear. And I mean, my students are in high school. They care very much about what other people think.
Oh, yes.
And
oh,
if God, they yes. could let go of some of that and just be free in who they are and what decision they're making right now, they would enjoy it so much more.
And they will eventually.
Of course.
But what happens is, and this is one of my little sayings, is we spend most of our lives climbing yesterday's mountain.
Mm.
And that's just what we do. And there's no way around it. It's like when I grew up in Oak Cliff, which is like 30 miles outside of Dallas, there were a lot of bullies in my neighborhood. One kid put a pitchfork through my foot. It was not a good place to be. There were some lovely people there, but there were mean people there. And I guess that's true with a lot of people. Wherever you grow up, there are going to be bullies that are going to pick on you. But because of that, when I was in college and cared oh so much, and I had a teacher bully me, I knew what that looked like. I was not surprised. And the advantage I had in the situation was my experience. And so I knew who this person was and what this person was about. And I was able to protect myself. So just the message to your students is, a lot of the bad things that happen to you in high school are trivial, but at the same time, they cut deep.
Yeah.
But they also give you very powerful lessons that enable you to be stronger in your adulthood.
Mm. I agree. All right, last one. What's next for you, Stephen? What should we see you in next?
let's see, I just did a movie, and I just saw the screening of it with Chris Pine and Danny DeVito and Annette Bening, Jennifer Jason Leigh, John Ortiz. It's fantastic. I just saw it the other day. Pool Man just got finished, and it is a weird movie. I got to say it is weird, but it is kind of wonderful. And I left the movie theater, and my wife, Annie, she was just looking at me. She said, it's a hit. I want to see it again. And I said, I want to see it again, too. So that's coming out. That should be good. I just did a Hacks. It was always good working with Gene. Gene Smart.
So amazing.
Gene and I. We went in the Wayback Machine and Hartford Stage Company in 1980. Mm-hmm. Gene was just finishing a play there, and I was just starting a play there. And afterwards, we used to go out and get a beer up at the bar on top of the hill in Hartford. And it was so good as to where we were at the time in our lives and where we've ended up in our time in our lives that we're still in. Show business, we're still acting.
Yeah.
Jean's had this magnificent career. She's so damn good. And you know, I can't complain for someone who's lost all of his hair.
I think Eric just has a couple quick questions for you, and then we're gonna let you go and get some rest.
Okay. Yeah, I'll be brief. Two quick questions and one quick comment. Two of your roles that I wanted to ask you about. So you are in one scene in Spaceballs. A very memorable scene where they catch the stunt doubles, of course. any memories of working in that scene, working with Mel Brooks?
God, yes. So I was doing a play with Bill Pullman at the time at Los Angeles Theater Center, Barabbas. And Bill was talking in the dressing room how he's going to be doing this new Mel Brooks movie. And he said Mel was going to come see the show, Barabbas, which was a brutal, amazing show directed by the head of the National Theater of Norway, Stein Vinga. I mean, it was crazy. And Bill was the lead, and I played Pontius Pilate. And at the end of the show, Mel Brooks came up to me and says, hey, you know, there's a part in this new movie we're doing, Spaceballs, that you could be right for. Do you want to come in and audition? I go, God, yes, Mr. Brooks. Oh, God, yes. And I remember I called my mom and dad up and said, I have an audition with Mel Brooks, you know, coming up this week, Monday, for his new movie, Spaceballs. And that was such a thing for my mother and father, because they always knew I was going to be such a failure that there's no chance that I was ever going to be successful. I'm doing these plays in Los Angeles, Barabbas, like, who's going to see that? But they knew who Mel Brooks was. So I auditioned for Captain of the Guard in Mel Brooks's office. Mel said, you got the part, and what if we pay you $2,000 to do it? I was going like, oh, my God. Yes, sir. Oh, thank you, sir. Oh, my God. This is like amazing. He says, okay, so we'll shoot this scene on Monday. So I showed up on Monday, sat there all day, and the AD came to me. Well, we're not going to get to you today. Come back tomorrow. So I came Tuesday, still didn't get to me. Come back tomorrow. Wednesday, come back tomorrow. Thursday, come back tomorrow. Now I'm getting kind of like freaked out. And I'm thinking like, oh, my God, am I going to be cut out of this movie? Are they ever going to shoot my part? And I go to the AD and I said, you got to be kidding. I mean, and he says, how much are they paying you to do this? And I said, $2,000. He says, well, you get $2,000 every day you show up. And I go, what? $2,000 just to sit here and eat snacks? Yes, you get $2,000 every day you show up here. Oh, my God. And I went like, well, this is the business I want to be. This is it. So, yes, that it was. And it was hilarious working with Mel on the movie. He was hysterical. He was incredibly funny. And we worked again later on Mad About You. And he brought up all sorts of stories about Spaceballs. But Mel Brooks is like one of those once in a lifetime kind of talents. That and Norman Lear, once in a lifetime. Carl Reiner, once in a lifetime kind of talent. Rita Moreno. These people I've been lucky to meet in my life and work with even. And Mel Brooks is a brilliant director. And when you such a good to imagine him directing as well as he directed, and then to give that performance that he gives, it's amazing amount of energy for a person to have. So it's incredible.
Wanted to ask you, you're in only one scene, but you're a very memorable role in a Seinfeld episode. Tor Eckman, the incredibly wacky healer that turns George's skin purple. Any memories of that episode? Because you also got to be, it's a pretty long scene, and you're with Seinfeld and Jason Alexander and Michael Richards all in that scene.
Yeah.
Any memories of being in that scene?
Yeah, you have to remember that. I think that was first season. The second half of the first season, it was early on.
It's an old episode,
Old episode, so they had longer scenes and all that kind of thing. But Mark Hirschfeld, who was a very powerful and excellent casting director at the time. Now I think he's head of NBC or something. I mean, he went right up the ladder. But at the time, Mark was a casting director who had brought me in on a few things beforehand. I had a little baby at the time. My wife and I had our first kid. And Mark said, like, can you come in? We're having trouble making this part funny, and we want to know if you can make it funny. So I looked at the part. I went in that day and met with Mark and with Jerry, and we read through the scene. And it just so happened at that time I was working on a movie called Calendar Girl at Columbia Pictures, which was the same place where they did Groundhog Day. They called it Columbia Pictures back then, which is now called Sony. Mm-hmm. So for this movie, they taught me sign language for the deaf, me and Kurt Fuller. He played my brother in this movie. And so we were learned for 6 weeks. We had been given sign language because we were playing gangsters in this movie, and he was my brother. And so I had to sign to him all the things that were being said in the scene, and he would sign back to me. That was our gimmick for the movie. And Joey Pantaleone was in that movie too, as a matter of fact. So I went in on the Seinfeld audition and I said to Mark, I said, what if I, as Tor Eckman, I have signs for everything I say, signs for everything I do. And so that's when I go, I am a healer.
Yep.
And I started doing all these made up signs that were just kind of inspired by sign language for the deaf, which I had been learning with Kurt. And Jerry goes, yeah, that's kind of funny. Yeah, you could do that. Yeah, that'll work. So I got the part, and this is what I remember about Seinfeld. I've done a ton of sitcoms in my life. I do not remember a cast working so hard and so long on an episode. It was amazing. On shoot day, we rehearsed during the day. As I recall, we shot everything during the day before the audience came. So we rehearsed each scene and shot it. Then the audience came in. Jerry did the warm-up for the audience.
Wow.
Stand-up. So he jumped up, got in front of the audience, started doing stand-up, then would jump down onto the stage. We'd shot the entire show twice in front of the audience, let the audience go, and then we did pickups to something like 1:30 or 2 in the morning.
Oh, my goodness.
I have never seen a cast work so hard. And so with no goofing off, no nothing, everybody, Jason and Michael and Julia, everybody was in it every moment, all the time. It made an impression on me that lasted my whole life, because I've been on shows where people get kind of ticked off if they have to be there half a day, you know, especially on shoot days. But it was like amazing amount of work they put in.
That's great. Now, the only other thing I'll say, this is a comment, you don't even have to respond, but there are certain things that people see in movies or TV shows that for some reason strike them as very funny, and you're not really even sure why. In the movie Sneakers, for some reason, I've always found it hysterical when you say passport. And I can't explain why, but just I love the way that you deliver that line, and it always cracks me up.
That was one thing Phil Robinson, our director, did, and writer. Boy, what a good writer, what a good director. He also did Field of Dreams, of course, wrote and directed that.
Yes.
But for My Voice is My Passport, Verify Me.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did is, in terms of the recording, which I think was one of the first things we did, was me just recording. I did "My voice is my passport, verify me." My voice is my passport, verify me. My voice is my passport. And I did a whole bunch of different versions.
Hmm.
Then I think we did the bad, bad Leroy Brown scene.
Right.
with me and Mary.
Great
and
scene.
So I had already done all those passport. I already had basically rehearsed that scene by doing all of the recordings of Passport before. And so I always think like Sigmund Freud in his book, Jokes in Their Relation to the Unconscious, said the essence of comedy is making the meaningful meaningless or making the meaningless meaningful. So I thought that was a perfect example of there's this one word I want you to say for me. And I'm thinking it's going to be naughty. Negligé. You know, negligé. That it's going to be some R or X-rated word that she wants me to say to her because I'm expecting a hot date. And when it's passport, it's like, passport? Thank you.
Love it.
You know, but I knew I had already recorded that as one of my choices in the tape. So anyway, that was a great experience working with those people. My God. Oh, my God. What a great cast. Amazing.
Definitely.
The funniest experience I had in sneakers, besides listening to Ben Kingsley stories in the makeup trailer, which is like,
oh, my gosh,
amazing.
Even imagine.
Him on the road doing Shakespeare as a kid. It's just amazing theater stories, hilarious stories. But like we were shooting at Universal during this part of the scene where Robert Redford has to walk at 1/2 mile an hour through the maze without setting off the alarms and all that stuff. And it's also where James Earl Jones comes running into the scene. So James was on the set at the time. Robert was there. And the tour bus for Universal, if you've ever been at the Universal Studios, that tour bus goes all the time everywhere. Mm-hmm. And if you're working there on the lot, people are always there with their phones taking pictures of you. They don't know who you are, but they know you have a script in your hand, so you have to be some sort of actor. So the tour bus is going through where the drivers have a patter. Over here is the shark, Bruce, the shark from Jaws. Over there is the bicycle from E.T. Oh, over here is the, you know, and they're driving through seeing all their points of interest, and it's all memorized what they have. So we are called to the set. I get out of my little trailer and I look across the way and Robert and James Earl Jones are coming to the set and the tour bus is doing their tour thing with all the tourists there with their little cameras back then. They didn't have the phones. They had all their little Instamatic cameras taking pictures and the tour bus had to stop for Robert Redford and James Earl Jones, the two biggest actors in the world at the time, crossing in front of the tour bus. But the tour guide was not aware of this at all. And no one on the bus was aware of it at all. So they keep saying like, and over here is the shark from Jaws, and they're all going to the right side of the bus. And over here, oh, there's the bicycle from E.T., and they all rush to the other side of the bus. Whereas James Earl Jones, Robert Redford walk right in front of their bus and no one notices.
Oh, my gosh.
It was hilarious. So but Sneakers was a great, great movie. Great movie.
That's great.
Now, where was I?
Oh, my God. Stories.
Wow, was he a great guest. Wow, was that great.
Are we going to keep the fangirling and fanboying in the episode? Because, oh, my God.
maybe as an outtake.
What a delight to sit with us for this long and tell us so many stories.
And to have
incredible.
The flu while he's doing it. Incredible.
Yes, this poor man. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I am. Oh, boy. That
oh,
was
he's the fun. Best. You almost had me tearing up with the Harold Ramis stories. I wasn't expecting that. I should have expected that with Groundhog Day, but I didn't expect that. Oh, what a delight.
Now, where was I?
Did you find it, Art?
Yes. So the nominees that year were Memento, Amelie, Monsters Ball, Royal Tenenbaums, and Gosford Park, and Gosford Park won.
Oh, that was a good year. God, that was a good, yeah, Gosford Park with that. You know, and it's, Gosford Park is brilliant. As a mystery, I feel like this one is stronger, but I don't know, I could be biased.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I'm not often in line with the Oscars, but I've actually seen 3 out of 5 of those movies, yeah. Which I think is a big number for me compared to my normal percentage for, you know, Oscar nominated movies.
That was the first year I really started paying attention. Like paying attention hard, because I made sure I saw all of the Best Picture nominees. So that was the year of In the Bedroom and Gosford Park then. And I'm trying to remember what the others were, but I made sure, because normally I wouldn't have seen In the Bedroom or Gosford Park. Like those would have been movies I passed over. And so when I started paying attention, that was it. So 23 years ago, I started paying attention to the Oscars.
And of those three that I've seen, I actually still own all three of them. Amelie, this one, and Royal Tenenbaums.
No, I've never seen Amelie. I should probably fix that.
It's fantastic, but I probably haven't seen it myself in 20 years, yeah. But I do love it.
Well, I'll reveal this, and I know this is going to get me ripped to shreds by never. Fans, but of those five, I the only one I've seen in full is Memento, and the reason why is the only other one I saw in part was the Royal Tenenbaums, because my wife and I started watching it, and about 20 minutes in, we both hated it and turned it off. And I know that that's going to get me skewed a lot by movie fans, but just something about it, we did not like it and we stopped it.
That's okay. Everybody's got different tastes. It's what makes podcasting fun.
Yeah. And that's one of those movies where, you know, there is a different tolerance of watching. And I almost think that Memento can be lumped into this category a little bit, but different people have different tolerances about watching movies and stories about terrible people.
Mm. Yeah, see, that's right up my alley, though, so it makes me strange. I love things about terrible people.